Welcome to Writers on Writing on
KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and on the internet
at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests here include authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and the business of writing. Today my guest is Jane Ann Phillips, author of Mother Kind, published by Knopf. She is author of two other novels, Shelter and Machine Dreams, and two collections of widely anthologized stories, Fast Lanes and Black Tickets. She is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and two National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships. Her work has appeared most recently in Granta, Doubletake, and the Norton Anthology of Contemporary Fiction. She's currently writer-in-residence at Brandeis University. Hello, Jane Ann.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Mother Kind, a wonderful book, and the situation it deals with seems to be more and more common to many many people who are caring for an ill parent and maintaining their own family. And I'm curious how this idea came about.
Well, it really came about from real life. The book is certainly fiction, but the heart of it, and I think the heart of my need to write it, arose from my own mother's death 15 years ago, which feels like a very long time ago.
Mm.
It sort of feels like two lifetimes. But my mother did live with me for over a year in the last year of her life, and it was the first year of my first son's life. And I knew soon after her death that I wanted to write about it, but I was far from being at a point where I sort of had the distance to do that. And so I started working on a book called Shelter, which I think in a funny way is about orphans.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of manifestation of orphanhood in a kind of very primal setting. But sort of decided about 3 years ago that it was really time to finish this book, for which, you know, I'd had notes for a long time. And it became more and more of a fiction as I sort of turned it into a story. You know, I really think of it as a story of journeys, sort of metaphysical journeys, physical journeys, the journey back to one another, the journey into birth, the journey into death. I mean, sort of, I wanted all those things to sort of happen right against one another, and to make the book a kind of year in life, and to really use the seasons and the natural world as part of what's happening to them.
So, even though it had been 15 years since your mother's death, was it difficult to write?
Well, it was difficult to write. I mean, but it's always difficult to write, and I think that that may be the litmus test, that it should be very difficult, or at least it's always been for me. I always seem to write about whatever's most difficult for me to think about, whatever's most mysterious to me. I think in a way you wade into whatever's most dangerous, and hopefully through the process of writing the book, not just understand it, but sort of become what it was that frightened you.
Mm.
and sort of come out the other side.
Mm.
And I wanted, I constructed the book in such a way that life keeps getting lived, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to give away the ending too much, but people have told me that, you know, it's an extremely moving book, but also, I think, a very hopeful one.
Yeah. Mothers and daughters, families, people, a lot of your work. Do you choose your themes, or do they choose you?
I think they choose me. I mean, I think language chose me a long time ago, and I sort of came to writing as a poet, and I still really write via language. The first line of a book always occurs to me just as the first line, and I never sort of know what's inside the world of that line, and I need to write the book to find out. But mothers and relationships with mothers, relationships going back generations, between mothers and daughters, women as a matrilineal line, the things that we inherit from our parents, you know, not only gestures or facial characteristics, but they're sort of unresolved griefs and unresolved mysteries. that I think we figure out in the way we live our lives, even if we don't consciously know what they are. That was something that I have always sort of worked with words.
Hmm. So if the first line comes to you, does it usually remain?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it ends up being further back in the book in a way. But usually, I mean, I sort of think about my books for quite a long time before I start writing them. I think the first, that little italicized section of Shelter mm-hmm. that sort of starts out about the sky. That song gets the sky burnt white to blonde to powder blue. That was a paragraph that was in my notebook maybe 15 years before the book was written. You know, and I knew that it was a book about these girls and at this camp, and that was sort of all I knew. So I sort of have pieces of books in my notebooks that I do end up making books to go, you know, I end up making books to go with them.
Mm-hmm. Will you read from Motherkind?
Oh, sure. I'll read a sort of a little short piece to begin with that is about Kate and her newborn. At this point, the baby's about a week old.
And if you've just tuned in, this is 88.9 FM, KUCI. My guest is Jane Ann Phillips, and she's about to read from her latest novel, Motherkind.
She heard a small sound. Alexander lay in the bassinet, his eyes open, looking at her. His swaddling blankets had come loose, propped on his side by pillows. He raised one arm and moved his delicate hand. He had a watchful, observing look, and the more excited look, he would open his eyes wider, compress his lips, strain with his limbs, as though he was concentrating on moving, on touching, or grasping. He could feel his body, but he couldn't command it to move or do. His focus was entirely in his eyes. And he did focus. Kate was sure he saw her. He wasn't a newborn any longer. Today, he was 1 week old. Perhaps his vision was still blurry. That was why he peered at her so intently. His eyes were big and dark blue, like those of a baby seal. Now Kate wiped his cheek carefully with the edge of a cloth diaper, then drew her finger across his forehead, along his jaw, across his flattened, broad little nose. She touched his collarbone in the line along his shoulder under his gown. His skin was like warm silk, and his manes were too big for him. She cleaned him with warm water, not alcohol wipes, and used a powder that contained no talc. The powder was fine as rice flour and smelled as Kate thought rice fields might smell in the sun, and the plants bloomed like clean food, pure as flowers. Across the world and in the south, those young shoots grew and moved in the breeze like grass. Outside, the wind moved suddenly along the house. Kate heard it circling and testing. Suddenly, a gust slammed against the windows, and the baby startled to look toward the sound. The wind would bring snow again, Kate knew. Already she heard snow approach like a whining in the air. Absently she traced the baby's lips and he yawned and began to whimper. You're hungry, Kate thought. He moved his arms as though to gather her closer. Her milk let down with a flush and surge, and she held a clean diaper to one breath as she put him to the other. Now she breathed, exhaling slowly. The intense pain began to ebb. He drank the cells of her blood, Kate knew, and the crust that formed on her nipples where the cuts were deepest. He was her blood. When she held her, he was inside her, always. He was near her, like an atmosphere, in his sleep, in his being. She would not be alone again for many years, even if she wanted to, even if she tried. In her deepest thoughts, she would approach him, move around and through him, make room for him. In nursing, there would be a still, spiral peace, and energy in which she felt herself, her needs and wants, slough away like useless debris. It seemed less important to talk or think. Like a nesting animal, she took on camouflage, layers of protective awareness that were almost spatial in dimension. The awareness had dark edges, shadows that rose and fell. Kate imagined terrible things, that he might stop breathing, that she dropped him or someone had, that someone or something took him from her, that she forgot about him or misplaced him. There were no words. The thoughts occurred to her in starkly precise images, like the unmistakable images of dreams. as though her waking and sleeping lives had met in him. Truly she was sleeping. Days and nights were fluid, beautiful and discolored. Everything in her was available to her, as though she'd become someone else, someone with a similar past history in whom that history was acknowledged rather than felt, someone who didn't need to make amends or understand, someone beyond language. She was shattered. Something new would come of her. Moments in which she crossed from consciousness to sleep, from sleep to awareness. There was a lag of an instant in which she couldn't remember her name, and she didn't care. She remembered him. Now his gaze met hers, and his eyelids fluttered. She could see him falling away, back into his infant swoon. His sleep closed around him like an ocean shell and rocked him within it. In this they were like Cape Bot, though he had no name known to him, no name to forget.
Thank you. That was Jane Ann Phillips reading from Mother Kind, and you're tuned into 88.9 FM KUCI in Orange County, California. I'm going to read something about you. I have a question.
This is
a most intriguing piece in an article, actually, about you in Salon Magazine back in April. A mutual friend, Beth Keppert, wrote, and this is the beginning of the article, and then I have a couple of questions. I first met Jane Ann Phillips in a city of puppets on a night of daggering rain. It was Prague, the summer of 1995. She was across a gilded mirrored room, across a table strewn with apples and cheddar, and I remember watching how she moved through the writers who had assembled there, moved through them, touched a hand to them, then escaped them just in time. I remember how her long crimped hair sat on her shoulders like a cape, like depth, a protection. She seemed otherworldly among the rest of us, unspoiled by the rain. She seemed to be dismayed by all the crackling, smacking loudness. Standing there, observing Phillips, I was struck by contradictions, as readers of her work have always been. Here was the originator of characters who marched straight out of the dark side and spoke straight out of the dark side and spoke, "Jamaica, you black doll," wobbling like a dead girl sewn of old socks. Here was the author of Tender Reminiscence. My mother's ankles curve from the hem of a white suit as if the bones were water. Here was the teacher at Brandeis, at Harvard, at Boston University, elsewhere, with the reputation for being obsessed with the minuscule, the line edit, the word, and its hyphen, the punctuation mark. This is very intriguing. So I have two questions. Have you always been obsessed with the minuscule?
Well, with detail, certainly, because I think that's where the real information is. It does sort of drive students crazy sometimes, particularly if they're beginning to write rather than drowning in writing or sort of already deep into it. But
so what might you do? What might you do with a student who's starting out, and for instance, in terms of the minuscule?
Well, it's not really the minuscule. It's the sentences in the work. You know, we do line editing, which, you know, some people, I guess, don't get the benefit of until they're graduate students. But, you know, people all teach writing in different ways. But it seems to me that you look at the sentences, and, you know, we always sort of talk generally about the story or the piece, and then we kind of look at at least the first several pages and talk about the lines themselves and how they might be changed or improved, or why one line really works beautifully, and, you know, that kind of thing.
My other question in regards to this piece, and in general probably, is that the Keppert's piece portrays you as very mysterious, and I wonder if you see yourself that way.
Well, Beth is a novelist. You can tell that from the first line of that piece. It's not that I see myself that way. I think I see all of us that way. I mean, I think there's so much that we intuit and yet don't know. And there's so many secrets that we've kind of been born into that we only know by sort of moving slowly through them. Some of them are inherited, and some of them are secrets that we managed to make for ourselves. I mean, I remember when I first read Four Quartets, the Eliot poem, you know, there is those lines at the end about coming to the place we started. and knowing that place for the first time. I mean, I think that's basically the process of getting from the cradle to the grave, you know, that we do finally see where we are. And that's a miraculous journey. And I think the way the writer discovers it is in the details. And that's what language delivers, you know, sort of delivers it in words. And it's always fascinated me that you know, language, though it's completely non-dimensional, and it's simply this, you know, these little symbols put together in various combinations, you know, that each and every word that we use, that we read, that we think in, has behind it a kind of whole subconscious text that we use without even being aware of it. And it's just always been amazing to me that the reader is really half the book. The reader is always half the book. And I think you write for that reader who, you know, carries the book with them long after they put it down, and who goes on to make something of it in their own heads that you may never know about.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because my next question actually was about the reader and how you hope your work affects the reader, or when you're writing, how mindful are you of the reader? Or are you simply writing as if it will never get published and you're writing because this is a story that you need to tell?
Well, I think it's the writer's responsibility not to think about the reader, because that's kind of like thinking about the teacher or thinking about the parent, or, you know, it immediately sort of cuts off what you can do. And I think you have to be working into the text and working into the material and letting the material sort of dictate the form it's going to take. It's just really kind of walking a tightrope without the rope. It's kind of a strange kind of almost like a meditational type of practice that has to do with emptiness and silence, and, you know, words kind of rising up the way they do on the bottom of one of those eight balls, or, you know. Not that there's not craftsmanship involved, because of course there is, but the way a book comes together and what it ends up including and the structure that you finally find for it all has a, you know, remains pretty mysterious. So I don't think about the reader, you know, while I'm writing. I mean, I think a book is, you know, it's sort of like the message in the bottle. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, you make it into what it is. And I think my books all are obviously the work of the same person in terms of their obsessions and sort of the, what they work into. But they're written differently, and they all seem to have different groups of fans. Mm-hmm. You know, people who love one book may not love another. I mean, of course, there are some people who, I suppose, who like them all. But I often meet someone who has just had a very kind of a gut reaction to one book or another. And it's just interesting to me that, you know, but that's the way readers find books. You know, they find books that really are going to matter to them.
Mm-hmm. I remember when your first collection of short stories came out, Black Tickets, in 79, I think it was, and it was so literary, so explicit, bizarre in certain respects, and very impressive, and also I lent it out to somebody, and if that person's listening, please return it, because I really miss having that book. So wherever you are, return Black Tickets to me. Call me, I'll give you my address, but anyway. But that book put you on the literary map, and I wonder how its critical acclaim affected you and your writing.
Well, I just sort of kept going, you know. I mean, I think it was a startling book at the time, and in a funny way, it's still, I think, a startling book. And I hope that, I mean, I sort of think of Motherkind as being the opposite end of the spectrum, as it's meant to be a moving book, and it moves in a much slower, more meditative, you know, at a completely different type of pace. but both books work very much through language. And I think the test, you know, really is, you know, after 20 years, is a book still startling or is it still moving?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just hope that it will be. I never connected myself too much to whatever was said about the work because I feel very separate from the work. And I think you have to have that distance from all of that to be able to keep writing in the way that you would have if no one had ever read you,
mm-hmm.
which I think is what you have to do,
mm-hmm.
is to just simply descend into wherever you're going without anything to sort of restrain you or protect you.
It's interesting because that seems to be one of the most difficult things for especially new writers to do and also perhaps not so new writers. As you said earlier, write what is most dangerous, most difficult. And that seems to be the most difficult thing to do, to write as if the people you care about most will never read it, or to just let it rip and not worry about it.
Well, I was speaking more of danger to the self. Danger to the writer, as opposed to people who think they see themselves in the work.
Oh, that's what I'm talking about,
yeah.
Too, that writers will stop themselves because they don't want to reveal,
mm-hmm.
Reveal themselves.
mm-hmm. But I think, writing is always the way out of the self. I mean, I feel as though writing offers access. I mean, I think you can get to a place that's bigger than anything your own personality could have come up with. And you do that through language, and it's only through approaching it again and again and again that you kind of get to the place where that thing can happen.
Mm.
And so it's not just about the writer or the self or where the work started. It moves into something that is much bigger, that sort of is that, you know, the collective soul or whatever that Jung talked about,
mm-hmm.
I think is very much represented by language, and that's why no matter where we are, who we are, we can enter into a line of prose and be completely inside it.
It's interesting. And on that note, we will take a very short break and be back in just a few minutes with Jane Ann Phillips, author of Mother Kind. Please stay with us.
opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
We're back with Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine and on the internet at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Jane Ann Phillips, author of Motherkind, published by Knopf. As a teacher, how does teaching affect your own writing?
Well, pretty badly. I don't usually write while I'm teaching. I teach one semester a year. And I find it sort of a relief and a good thing to be able to talk to other people about books and kind of be outside my own office, out there in the world. But I don't really try to do my own work because I think a lot of the energy that you put into teaching, it's sort of the same energy that you need to write. So I typically try to write the rest of the year.
Do you like touring? Do you go on book tours?
Yeah. I don't know. It's always both. It's sort of like a roller coaster. It's both very interesting and sort of horrible. but it's interesting in terms of reading the work sort of again and again and again. I think you begin to see it in a little bit, in a way that's a bit different. Mm-hmm. I always have the experience of, sort of looking back at a book I've written after, a year or many years. It's the strangest feeling to sort of open it up and read, some of the words. It's as though they've emerged from your own blood, sort of know them in a way that's stronger than memory, and yet they seem very, very far away.
Mm-hmm. Is your favorite book whatever you're working on, or do you have a favorite story or book?
No, I see them as a continuum,
Mm-hmm.
I see one as making way for the next. I think they are connected in that way. I mean, I feel as though Black Tickets was the way I entered into understanding what a book was, and that I was... I wanted to write books that taught the reader how to read them, and I think in a way that's what I've kept doing.
Mm-hmm.
Black Tickets was a sort of book that had to do a lot, I think, with mobility and with anger and with moving, with energy, with a kind of survivor's energy. And Machine Dreams, of course, sort of looked back at where that energy had come from and what had made it, and kind of moved back. It was a kind of generational story in a funny way, in a kind of newly invented way. And then Fastlane was a book of stories that sort of moved further into, I think, my writing long prose. And then Shelter was a kind of, very, I think, scary, very, very dark, secret type of story. And, in a way, I see Shelter and Motherkind as really being about the same thing, but they approach it completely differently, and they use language completely differently. I wanted Motherkind to be written in a very accessible, clear, clarified voice, because it is about things that are so deep and mysterious and frightening, and they're completely commonplace things. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a kind of passion play like Shelter was. It's what all of us at some point or another experience. And I wanted really to invite people into it. And, hopefully that's what the book does.
Mm-hmm. Would you read to us again?
I'm going to read from a section that has a lot of dialogue in it so that you can sort of hear Kate and her mother and get a sense of the way they talk.
Mm-hmm.
This is a section from early on in the book when, again, the baby is quite young. The title of the book comes from a postpartum care agency that Kate's mother hires for a week to help Kate in the first week when she's back with her newborn. So Motherkind is, in fact, the name of the agency. Is the one that they leave after a week. The Motherkind worker, his name is Mara. Motherkind was finished. Kate herself was Motherkind. So it's, you know, quite obvious that this is a word that should enter our language if it hasn't already. But the Motherkind worker has been asked by Kate to read to her from David Copperfield earlier in the chapter. And that book, of course, begins, "I am born to begin my life with the beginning of my life," etc. And so when we refer to the book that Kate has been listening to, the book she asks her mother to read her, it's lines that are quoted, in case anybody wonders, are from David Copperfield. So this is the section. Mm-hmm. She had mastitis. Desperately, she wanted to walk outside into the cold, up and down the snowbound street. Antibiotics, her doctor said. Hot compresses and bed rest. Fluids, said her La Leche League counselor. Give it a day. Antibiotics are a last resort. No one can really know how they'll affect the baby. Nurse even more frequently. Change compresses as soon as they begin to cool. If the fever reaches 102, take Tylenol. Is there someone there to help you? Mom, please, Kate said now. Open the window. Don't be ridiculous. You're feverish, and you have an infant here. Lie down and cover up. The water's good and hot. I just don't want to burn you. She came to Kate's bed with an aluminum basin in her arms, and Kate looked inside it at the steaming claws. Let me change that compress again, her mother said. How long would you say the heat really lasts? Oh, 100 years or so. I know you're restless, her mother said. Could you read? Shall I turn on the TV? No, Kate said, and threw off the coverlet. You're so efficient, Mom, but I don't see how we can go on like this all day. Weren't you just here 3 minutes ago? Catherine removed the cooling cloth and laid the hot one carefully across Kate's breast. Could we see if Mara could come back? That's not necessary. Kate held her hand above the steaming cloth. We can't afford another week of Motherkind, and this is not rocket science. It's hot washcloth. We have to keep them this hot, her mother said. The more constant we keep the heat, the more likely you are to get results. You've worked so hard at this, I don't want you to have to stop nursing. I'm not stopping, Kate said incredulously. Who said anything about stopping? Well, no one, her mother said worriedly. You would only stop if your health were at stake. Kate sighed. I see you've got the coverlet in your hand. Don't come at me with it. Unless someone has chills, you really don't bundle up a person with a fever. You only make them hotter. Where did you go to medical school, anyway? Mastitis is not serious. It's almost de rigueur. Nursing mothers who don't get it are really not even respectable veterans. I wouldn't be concerned about your status, her mother said. With all you've got on your plate, you'll surely come out of this a veteran of something. Is that clock cool yet? Mom, you'll make yourself tired. Please sit down. If you want to distract me, read to me. There, read from what Mara started. Not the first lines. I don't want to hear them again. Start anywhere on the first page. Kate watched as her mother pulled the rocking chair close to bed and felt for the book behind her on the seat where Mara had left it. I was born with a call, she began uncertainly. No, no, Kate said. Skip the whole beginning. I heard it earlier today and came down with a fever. Go near the end when it's all coming right. Didn't you ever read this book? Doesn't everyone have to read it in high school? Good heavens, I don't remember what I read in high school. Do you want the very last pages? No, a little earlier. Do the reunion scene. You'll like it. She took the book from her mother's hand and turned it to the right page. Start with, Agnes, shall I tell you what about? I came to tell you. Right here. Print is so small, I feel as though I need my glasses changed. Her mother leaned back slightly and peered at the page through her bifocals. Do you doubt my being true to you, what I've always been to you, that part? Right. You have a secret, said I. Let me share it, Agnes. Now, if you know it from memory, why do you want me to read it to you? Because I love it, of course, and who wouldn't? Said I, let me share it, and the way he keeps repeating her name. My God, why don't people speak to one another that way every day, every hour? People don't necessarily want to share secrets. Maybe I should read something else. The point of this was not for you to get upset. I'm not upset. Kate leaned back on the pillows, took a breath, and lowered her voice to a near whisper. Just read, please, beg me. Said I, her mother intoned. All right, I'll start at the top of this page. She began to read, and Kate trained her eyes on a middle distance, a space informed by winter light. When Kate peered into that space correctly, the snowy view of descending streets and drifted roofs lost specificity and interest. Her eyes rested in emptiness that held nothing but a particular light, day, and time. The space seemed concave, difficult to hold or see if one tried, but effortlessly present within a certain focus. The mode of the listener was that focus, and Kate let herself enter it, drifting and aware. like active dreaming, infant dreams, dreams in which the body suddenly flexes while the mind moves into other stories. Dickens' language was a story Kate knew, shadowed, burnished, and detailed. Even the descriptions of filth and ruin rendered in language so controlled and rich, so confident that the stories exist and listeners hear. Dickens' listeners were gone now, gone, all those living souls who paid to hear him speak in lecture halls and stages, who stood within reach of his voice, all companions to a homeless boy, travelers to the death house, the poorhouse, all of them moving along streets made of stone, the horse-drawn wagons creaking, the clotted mud on planks and boots. It was always winter in Dickens' London boyhood, always cold and foggy, and the bridges so long one couldn't see to the other side through wet, cloying mist. Everyone's hands looked chapped and old, so Northern European, Kate thought, with white, mottled skin, like the fainting off hands of kids from the coal town, kids with old eyes. They knew how to say goodbye, those children, lined up in school hallways in their wrinkled coats, chafed wrists, delicate and dirty. They were children from her mother's classrooms, children her mother had taught to read and write, children she'd clothed with whatever her own kids had outgrown. They boarded school buses at day's end and never waved, only looked, sideways glances through their rectangular windows. Kate had thought no one kissed them. She thought they'd be cold forever. Now in her mind's eye, they cast their clear gaze through Dickens' unfurled words. Twilling on, saw a ragged, wayward boy, forsaken and neglected. In Sri Lanka, in India, babies burned with cholera or malaria. Moist skin, dark, lustrous hair. Those babies could drown in dense scent, even through the membranes of their mother's body, through the protective call of Dickens' story. Any story. Kate washed her mother's mouth, a mouth not so generous as Kate, a rosebud mouth perfectly suited to the bright red lipstick she'd worn. All the years Kate had stood near her, looking up, the daughter so small in stature, or followed her skipping to keep pace, her mother's black coat disappearing along grocery aisles, corridors, slushy streets. Dimly she heard the words her mother read. Long miles of road then opened out before my mind. Goodbye was not so simple as a kiss. Goodbye went on and on. Mom, wait, Kate said softly. Her mother stopped reading and raised her eyes, startled. I'm sorry, Kate said. I wasn't concentrating. I missed the part I really wanted to hear. Can you go back a bit and read the underlined paragraph? Her mother glanced at the book and moved her chair closer to the bed, then half stood, reaching to touch the cooling cloth that lay across Kate's breast. But Kate gestured to leave it be and nodded, encouraging her to go on. I went away, her mother read, loving you. I stayed away, loving you. I returned home, loving you. And now I tried to tell her of the struggle I had had and the conclusion I had come to. I tried to lay my mind before her truly and entirely. There was a hush in the room. Kate's mother looked back at the lines once. Then she leaned forward and touched her open palm to Kate's face. Kate touched her own hand to her mother's wrist and inclined her head as her mother stood to embrace her. Listening, she heard the beating of her mother's heart as snow brushed the windows in sweeps of wind.
Very nice. Very nice. That was Jane Ann Phillips reading from Mother Kind on Writers on Writing, 88.9 FM, KUCI. Kate and her mother's relationship is so enviable and so poignant. And, gosh, I would imagine there were times during the writing of this book that were just, I don't know, so, there's the word difficult again, just getting through and writing something so emotional, so close to you, and yet having it work, I think must be a great challenge.
Yep.
You know, often the emotional stuff that comes out, it's not necessarily working. And then you put distance, and then that doesn't work either. And here you have all of it.
Well, in a funny way, I mean, I've always sort of said that writing is a kind of asbestos suit that you sort of sip on and walk in flames inside. And I think that's true not only of, you know, writing about things that you're not supposed to write about or writing in language that's forbidden or writing about something that's forbidden. It's also about writing about whatever is most anguishing to you, or what has been in the past. And I think, I don't know, I think there's a way in which the writer moves into the material that simply can't be done any other way. It's a kind of what you know about the book and the process you went through writing it is something you almost feel at a cellular level. It's not something you can even really explain, even though you've written it in language. You can't quite explain it in words.
You mentioned earlier something to the effect of writing as a sort of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do anything, any sort of rituals, any sort of writing exercises, or any sort of anything to get you into a certain state of mind?
Well, I think the only thing that I do to get myself into a certain state of mind is not write. You know, not write while I'm waiting to write is always one of the hardest things about the way I relate to writing. I sort of call it the high anxiety method. I mean, I think that I'm extremely self-censoring, and I think about things for a long time before I kind of start working on them. That's why many of the lines stay once I actually get them on the paper. It might take years to get to those lines. So I think dealing with silence is the ritual that I engage in. That feels like a kind of meditation, except that instead of sort of trying to empty oneself, what you're trying to do is gain access, not only to the self, but to what's way beyond the self, sort of where into where everybody is. I felt as though death took my mother away from me, and somehow language was going to bring her back. Not in the sense, of course, of a physical presence, but I think when you go through a long illness like that, you know, with someone who really is family, who's part of your identity, maybe too close a part of your identity, you face a lot of things that you could not even have framed in your mind up until that point. And I wanted somehow in the course of working my way into this book to find out, you know, how to sort of get back the relationship that, in a way, the illness for a while decimated, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I suppose that's one way that, one thing that grief is that decimation.
Mm.
And I suppose it took me that, you know, that many years to sort of work my way through that grief and make something out of it that's much bigger than grief.
So when you talk about the silence, are you talking about, say, and not writing, are you talking about, say, when you're teaching and gestating and thinking? Are you talking about when you go to write, waiting until it's time for the work?
Well, there's a big silence and a little silence. I was sort of thinking about the time between books, you know, when I sort of know what it is I'm approaching, but I haven't really started into it, you know. I sort of live the three lives that most women live. I'm a parent, and I'm a teacher, and I'm an artist. And, you know, I have a job. My job is writing. So it's sort of like there's three things going on all the time. And it's hard sometimes to find the silence in which to really think enough about work and to be alone with it enough that it can happen. And I think once you're involved in a book, once you've started into a book, my experience has always been the book has to be powerful enough and real enough to me, even if it's in its earliest stages, that I can get back to it from my life. You know?
Mm-hmm.
That I can get back to it and recognize it and get inside it again. So I feel like right now I'm sort of in the big silence. You know, the one, I'm going to finish this book and I know what I'm going to do next. And in fact, I have pieces of it that I'm trying to find again. You know, really get back into the writing of it. And I think, you know, there's a little final stuff like getting started every day once you're into the book.
Oh, yes. This is 88.9 FM with KUCI. My guest is Jane Ann Phillips, author of Mother Kind. You're listening to Writers on Writing. Now, you're at a writer's retreat right now, and is this what you do when you need to kind of gather all that and begin?
Well, I met McDowell Colony, which is a wonderful space up in New Hampshire, near the Monadnock Mountains. And
are you in a phone booth?
I'm in a phone booth. It's hot in here. It's the only phone booth in the whole place. But I actually had not done anything like this for a long time because I had kids. Still have kids, but I mean, I had kids at home. And I did not sort of go away for weeks at a time until really last year when both of them went away for weeks at a time to their own sort of summer projects or summer camps or whatever. So this year I've sort of for a second time sort of tried this business of having some space to myself, and I highly recommend it. But it sort of happened, you know, because it fits into my kids' schedule. So mm-hmm. I mean, I think my work sort of happens at the outer boundaries of my own life and of their life.
Mm-hmm. The section you wrote that was largely dialogue, what is the key to writing dialogue? Dialogue that works.
Oh, well, I think it just has to do with voice, and voice has to do with character. And I think that this mother's voice, I mean, it's recognizable in Black Pickets. I mean, it's recognizable in a couple of the stories in that book and in Fast Lane. It is sort of based on the way my mother really talked. But of course, the things the characters are saying are not things that were ever really said. Mm. So it's a kind of composite of rhythm that is real, and imagination, and what the book needed to, where the book needed to go. So it's a kind of combination. I mean, I think the writer has to have a tremendous stake in the work. It has to come from somewhere. It doesn't always have to come from life, or it comes from life in a very concerted way. I mean, there was, you know, what was that story that a writer is somebody who's walking along a dark road in a summer night and passes an open window and hears two minutes of conversation. And that's the beginning of a story or a novel or whatever. Mm. But it's hearing that real conversation. And whether that conversation took place in memory or in subconscious or in some reality that really the writer knows nothing about but has only sort of merely caught a glimpse of, in some way it has to connect in a very primal way to what the writer needs or needs to know. And I think that's how it gets started.
Do you believe that a novel can change a person's life?
Definitely. I would hope so. I certainly know that novels could change my life.
Which novels?
A Death in the Family. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the way novels change lives are, they happen slowly. I don't think it's like being pulled out of the way of a bus, exactly. It has more to do with, I think, those books are books we've read again and again and again. You know, the texts we sort of go back to because they're deeply, deeply full for us for some specific range of reasons. And there were just, I think all of us, that is all of us who are readers, probably have certain stories or certain poems that we go back to again and again because there's something at the heart of them that we know very well, but we keep checking to make sure it's still alive. by looking back at that story or that book. So I think, you know, books definitely change individual lives, and I think together, you know, they stand as a kind of conscience, or conscience inside culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think about American writers, Russian writers, Eastern European writers, and the way that the body of the work of a group of writers begins to stand for a certain time, and sort of comes at that time maybe from very different angles, yet they illustrate that time and embody that time in a way that's absolutely immediate, no matter how long ago it was. And it's only language that really can do that. I think only writers can do that.
Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes left. You write novels and you write short stories. What for you is the difference between them, other than obviously the length?
Well, I don't really write. I think of myself as writing language, you know. Mm. When I was trying to write my first novel, someone said to me, don't worry about it being a novel, it's a book.
Mm.
You're writing a book.
Mm-hmm.
And the book will teach you how to write it. I mean, for the past several years, I really have been involved in novels because I need the relationship that I can have with a novel. I need a relationship that can go on for several years,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, that I can get completely inside the material. But yet I go about constructing books in the same way that I really went about constructing Black Tickets. I mean, it has to do with layering, with patterning, way one thing plays off another, more than it has to do with the old-fashioned idea of beginning, middle, and end. I've never really believed in plot. You know, I sort of believe more, I guess, in perception.
Yeah.
The idea that plot is inside perception, and that if I can get that across in language, the plot is there. Like the plot is inside it. So I'm not a good person to ask because I don't really see a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think stories and novels handle time differently, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And novels are trying to sustain time. It's sort of that's the challenge of it. And I guess for me right now, that's what I'm most interested in, is that suspension.
I really wish we had more time. This is like a whole other subject now about plots and perception. This is very interesting, and we're at the end of our time. Hate that when that happens.
Well, it was fun talking to you.
Great to have you. A great delight. Thank you so much for standing in that hot, sweaty booth, spending an hour with us. And thanks.
You're welcome.
Alrighty.
All right. Take care.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Jane Ann Phillips, author of Motherkind, and I'm serious, I want to talk about plot inside perception. Next time, I suppose. If you have any comments or questions, please email me through my website at writersonwriting.com. And I'd like to leave you with a quote by Fran Lebowitz. Here goes. Children ask better questions than do adults. May I have a cookie? Why is the sky blue, and what does a cow say, are far more likely to elicit a cheerful response than, where's your manuscript, why haven't you called, and who's your lawyer? I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, signing off at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California. Thank you for listening.